For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program. We bring you the Indie Week, a weekly journal brought to you from ncreadingservice.org and read by John Federson. Today, the issue dated March the 21st of 2024. And we've gotten out of the habit of acknowledging our fine musicians, whoever they may be, providing our theme music. So we'll regain that policy starting now. And these exciting duo are full-time faculty from the Name on Request Correspondence Academy of Music, .URP. And we'll be listening to them at the end of our program, which comes in about 1 hour's time. And out they go. Now, first to the what I would consider hard news. It's reasonably fairly thin this week. There's a lot of arts and other material that we can fit into our time. First, about Durham Survivor Care. In Durham's next budget, some residents hope to see the city fund a 3-year pilot program called the Office of Survivor Care, which would offer support to survivors of gun violence and their families using restorative justice methods, such as facilitative listening circles and peer support groups. The pilot would be housed within the Community Safety Department. Unlike Durham's other publicly funded survivor support services, which the police department and the DA provides, the Office of Survivor Care wouldn't limit its services to survivors who are involved in ongoing trials or investigations. The proposal for the pilot states, survivor support can't focus merely on the survivors of violence when an arrest was made and a criminal trial ensued. For one thing, many harmed by violence never report the incident to crisis response or law enforcement. For another, only a fraction of the violent incidents reported to law enforcement result in an arrest, and of those, only a fraction result in any criminal trial. Even those trials provide little healing to violence survivors and their families. The pilot's initial year would cost $220,000, and its second and third year would cost $820,000. More than one-third that funding would be used to cover funeral and burial expenses for homicide victims' families, and would be reimbursed by the North Carolina's Crime Victims Compensation Fund. This pilot has already had its own pilot of sorts. From 2022 to 23, the Community Safety Department collaborated with NC Central, Duke, and Restorative Justice Durham on a program called Prescriptions for Repair that encouraged survivors of gun violence to share their stories during a series of listening sessions. At the Durham City Council's budget meeting hearing on Monday, many of the residents who called on the city to fund this Office of Survivor Care had volunteered as facilitators for Prescriptions for Repair, including the former State of Things radio host Frank Stacio. Stacio told a story of a survivor he worked with who initially said they weren't affected by gun violence, but then, quote, broke down several times and cried and said, I've never done this before. And then asked if he could speak with us even when the money ran out. And then asked if he could volunteer, said Stacio. And going on, he said, this is the kind of thing that clinicians and psychologists and therapists talk about with us all the time. Hurt people, healed people, heal people. Without healing the trauma that's rampant in our community, it's unlikely that enforcement is enough to do the job to keep the public safe. Next up, Justin Laidlaw writes, Open house for Roxborough Mangum Street redesign sees a large turnout. More than 200 Durham residents packed the gymnasium at Global Scholars Academy on Roxborough Street on Tuesday evening for an open house about proposed street design changes in downtown Durham. The City of Durham's Transportation Department and North Carolina's DOT invited residents to speak with staff and leave public comments to express their enthusiasm or concerns about the redesign of Roxborough and Mangum Streets. Many folks walked from their homes in the surrounding neighborhood to attend the meeting, including Durham resident Brittany Price. She says she constantly worries about the safety of folks in her street, especially children, because of how fast drivers are speeding, saying, I've seen almost every telephone pole on my block replaced because of crashes. It's really frightening for pedestrians and cyclists. I don't ride a bike because the road is so intense. Posters and information tables were spread throughout the gym. Folks crowded the stations to write feedback on sticky notes, which were placed on a map of the design area, which is a roughly 2-mile stretch between Lakewood Avenue and the I-85 interchange near Duke Park. Comments range from keeping the streets as they are to making one of the one-way lanes exclusive to bikes or buses, or redesigning them as two-way streets. The amount of engagement was encouraging for city staff. Sean Egan, director of the City of Durham Transport Department, was thrilled with the turnout they got. Egan says that better sidewalks, bike lanes, and more safety infrastructure were other common suggestions. Overwhelmingly, the root of all residents' concerns is safety. Quote, we've heard, certainly from some of the residents in the community, there are just too many cars going too fast on the corridor, and we need to address that head on. I'm sure he didn't mean that the way it sounded. We've looked at the speed data and the number of cars and speed limits, but our experience is that just changing the speed limit does not impact the actual speeds that are happening on these roads. There has to be a change in the design of the road. Converting back to two-way streets requires restriping the road, essentially repainting, which NCDOT covers as part of its regular maintenance cost. But additional infrastructure like traffic signals, changes to curbs, other signage and poles is necessary to complete the conversion and would require more funding from the city. The Transport Department has requested those additional funds through Durham's Capital Improvement Plan, the CIP. Next Monday, March the 18th, that already happened. The council hosted the first of two budget public hearings. Residents shared their budget priorities for the 24-25 fiscal year. Last year, residents rallied around two issues, expanding the HEART program and providing a full-time Vision Zero coordinator. Both items were included in the current budget. Lauren Grove was hired in December to fill the Vision Zero coordinator position and has since worked across departments to understand the public safety needs throughout the community. She says there will be trade-offs to redesigning streets that historically carry high volumes of traffic. Lowering speeds and tighter lanes could cause more congestion. The community, she says, will have to decide if it's worth it. Quote, Vision Zero is the political will to choose and prioritize safety over those other objectives. We're talking about undoing almost a century of trying to solve congestion or solve for getting people quickly to where they need to go in a car. That's a long history that we're slowly taking a step back from and saying, wait, hey, this isn't working. People are continuing to get injured or die in crashes. Let's prioritize something else. Let's actually prioritize safely moving people. In 2020, the Durham City Council approved a two-way conversion of Roxborough and Mangum Streets based on recommendations from the Move Durham Transportation Study. After the public comment period closes later this year, the Durham Transport will work with NCDOT to hire an engineering team to design this new roadway. City staff estimates that the new street design on Roxborough and Mangum, if approved, would begin construction in 2026. Well, this is sort of related to Chapel Hill's vision for bus rapid transit begins to take shape. In Chapel Hill, buses painted Carolina blue shepherd students, residents, visitors, nurses, and workers up and down the town's roughly 8-mile-long north-south corridor. It's the college town's spine, comprising North Carolina Highway 86 and Martin Luther King Boulevard. Like all Chapel Hill bus routes, it's also fare-free for riders, thanks to a partnership between Chapel Hill, Carlboro, and UNC Chapel Hill. It's a perfectly fine service, and the town wants to make it even better for commuters with an upgrade to a bus rapid transit BRT system. The BRT, in a town nearly as old as the nation itself, is more than another tentative line on a map. It's an opportunity to showcase a progressive vision for the future, one based on busing, biking, walking, and affordability. A successful BRT could prove that it's possible to realize the dreams of greenways and sustainability that policymakers have promised for years, most recently in the Complete Communities Framework. U.S. Transport Secretary Pete Buttigieg said in a press release announcing the recommendation of a $138 million investment in this Chapel Hill BRT earlier this month, saying, "Public transportation connects people to jobs, school, family, and more. And when transit reaches more people and communities, its impact is even greater." If Congress approves that money, the town's transit department has an ambitious plan to transform the way people move along that north-south axis. Chapel Hill's transit director, Brian Litchfield, says it's one of our highest ridership routes. But that route is facing challenges. There's demand for more service, says Litchfield. But just adding more buses won't help if they all end up sitting in traffic. It also won't help to just add more lanes. That's the common instinct of planners from across the country since post-World War II era of the automobile began. BRT is designed to solve these problems by operating like a subway system, efficient and predictable regardless of road congestion, without ever digging a single tunnel. The system would rely on about 5 miles of exclusive bus lanes, allowing bus commuters to roll past auto traffic at any time of day. It would also deploy traffic signal technology, holding green lights longer for approaching buses in order to maximize their waiting times at red lights. The bus itself is the headliner, but the project also includes a multi-use path, basically a large bike lane, and improvements to the sidewalks along this corridor. Litchfield says it's going to improve bus service, but it's also going to substantially improve the ability for the community to be able to bike, walk, or move throughout that corridor in something besides a personal vehicle. By more effectively linking the park and rides at Eubanks Road and Southern Village, the town hopes to make the BRT so good that residents don't need to rely on a car, which policymakers see as an important step towards affordability in Chapel Hill. Even as residents and town leaders have split over methods for responsibly managing the town's growth, factions have generally agreed on an affordable housing plan and the need to make sure that the people who work in the town can afford to live there. The American Automobile Association estimates the cost of owning a car is more than $12,000 per year. That may not be much for the average tenured professor at UNC, but it's a hell of a hit to the wallet for someone making the state's minimum wage $7.25 an hour. The BRT has been in the works since as early as 2012, when Orange County voters approved a half-a-cent sales tax to raise money for public transport. With projected population growth and demand for transit services on the rise, a package of plans that also included the Durham-Orange Light Rail got Triangle residents dreaming about options for a future of connectivity. But the light rail plan had too many stakeholders and too high a price tag. It imploded before a single inch of track was laid. To this day, residents who are asked about light rail are apt to shake their heads and mutter in annoyance about Duke Hospital. That BRT plan, smaller and simpler meanwhile, kept quietly rolling along. Now it's gaining momentum where light rail failed. Litchfield doesn't find that comparison particularly helpful, saying, light rail was a whole different project and a whole different level related to funding and challenges related to stakeholders. Chapel Hill is not the first place in the Triangle to consider BRT. Raleigh's BRT, currently under construction, has come under fire because it was paired with a set of zoning changes to encourage denser development along that route. That issue is specific to Raleigh, given the placement of the route, but the tug of war between needed infrastructure improvements and their contribution to gentrification may play out in different ways in Chapel Hill as that project proceeds. And there will be plenty of time for those conversations, as it'll be at least 5 years before the wheels on the bus rapid transit hit Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. President Biden's Department of Transportation has recommended that Congress approve funding along with 13 other similar projects in the 2025 fiscal year budget. If approved on schedule, the town hopes to move through design and begin construction in 2026 or 27, with operation beginning in 29. But Litchfield is hesitant to put his faith in Congress's timeline, saying, never place a bet on what Congress will do. There is no guarantee until we reach notification from the Federal Transit Administration. Still, he says that most projects that get this far ultimately do receive funding. And after a long process, one recent step required a 1,300-page application from the Transit Department. The town is optimistic about the future, Chapel Hill Mayor Jess Anderson said to light applause at the council's work session. We all have the good vibes on making sure that gets fully funded by Congress. And in a subtle segue, only because it's Orange County, incumbent Orange County school board members to compete in a runoff election. Board of Education members Bonnie Hauser and Jennifer Moore will compete in a runoff election on May the 14th, Tuesday. The winner will not only keep their seat for four more years, but also determine which block, progressive or moderate, has a controlling majority on the school board for the next two. Moore and Hauser came in third and fourth, respectively, in the March 5th election for three board seats. Moore won 482 votes more than Hauser, but did not win a majority of votes as required by North Carolina law to take office. In the March election, Moore ran on a progressive slate with incumbent Kerry Doyle and newcomer Wendy Padilla, who won first and second place and cleared the necessary majority. Hauser, a moderate, was the top vote-getter for her slate, outperforming her more conservative allies, Cindy Schreiner and Michael Johnson, by about 300 and 700 votes, respectively. Moore and Hauser are both registered Democrats. Now, each block is set to hold the three seats on the seven-member board for at least the next 2 years. That frames the runoff election as a referendum on which group should wield the chair's gavel. Moore wrote in an email to Indy, "Sometimes we have to fight extra hard for the things we love. I look forward to continuing to make progress improving our schools." Hauser did not immediately respond to request for comment, but previously told WCHL Chapelboro, quote, "Can't wait to talk about voters, about my track record in supporting equity, and how we can do more to get needed resources to every student." In the initial election, voters weighed topics including the racial achievement gap, the so-called Parents' Bill of Rights, the definition of equity, crumbling facilities, and a $300 million education bond. It was also the first election since the current board, controlled by moderates, pushed out its last superintendent in a behind-the-scenes process that members still have not explained. An analysis of precinct results shows the Hauser's slate won in the more rural northern and western areas of the county. It's in precincts including Caldwell, Carr, Cedar Grove, Cheeks, Eflin, St. Mary's, and Tallars. Moore and her allies were anchored by strong showings in the Hillsborough area, in precincts including Cole's Store, Grady Brown, Hillsborough, Hillsborough North, Patterson, and West Hillsborough. The majority of early votes and absentee by-mail votes also went to Moore's slate. In its meeting to certify the election results, the County Board of Elections did not anticipate particularly high turnout in the upcoming runoff. Rachel Raper, director of the board, said the last school board runoff was in 2010. Turnout in that election, which was paired with the Democratic U.S. Senate second primary, was 7.8%. Every eligible voter in the Orange County Schools District, which is separate from the Chapel Hill-Carrboro School District, can vote in the May 14th runoff. Every eligible voter in the Orange County Schools District. Registered Republicans and unaffiliated voters who did not vote in the March 5th Democratic primary are also eligible to vote in the Republican second primary. That's for Lieutenant Governor and State Auditor. Elections, elections. Terrence Ruth announces a plan to run for Raleigh mayor this fall. Voters will see a familiar name on their ballots this fall. Terrence Truth Ruth, 41, a professor in North Carolina State University's School of Social Work and community activist, will run for mayor once again after narrowly losing to Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin in the race for the office in 2022. Ruth said in a press release announcing his candidacy, dated March the 14th, "We will be prepared to face the challenges of tomorrow by inspiring Raleigh to make different choices today. Our biggest challenges require long-term solutions. These are generated only when a city, not a small segment of a city, is invested in the process and the outcomes." Ruth's candidacy will focus on three principles: security, representation, and change, said the press release. Quote, "Emphasizing the need for authentic leadership and innovative solutions, Dr. Ruth is committed to challenging the status quo and championing policies prioritizing all Raleigh residents' well-being." Ruth holds a PhD in public affairs from the University of Central Florida and has worked as a teacher and principal in Wake County and is a nonprofit leader. The release says Ruth is deeply involved in local, state, and national social justice initiatives and leads coalitions to address local challenges through impact investing and creative collaborations, including projects to enhance affordable housing and innovate philanthropy. Ruth, who has not held elected office before, joins an already crowded race for mayor. Raleigh City Council member Corey Branch announced his candidacy this winter, as did former Raleigh Council member, state senator, and North Carolina treasurer Janet Cowell. Activist Del Monte Crawford, Republican mortgage broker Paul Fitz, and Peace University student James Shaughnessy IV have also announced their bids for the office. Mayor Marianne Baldwin has not formally announced whether she will run for re-election, but has said that she expects to. In 2022, Ruth received 41% of the vote to Baldwin's 47%. Community advocate DaQuanta Copeland placed third with 10% of the vote. The candidate filing period for this opens July 5th, and Election Day, as we probably mostly know, is November the 5th. All 8 city council seats will be on that ballot. All right, concluding most of the news or newsy articles, let's move on. It's still news, but let's talk about some cultural things. And first, we'll sort of visit 2 museums which have events or had events coming up. First is an article about Maria Magdalena Campos Pons and her shared identity titled Behold. Shared identity is a source of communal power. And that is playing right now or taking place at the Nasher Museum of Art, Durham, through June the 9th. It's now going on. In 2014, this artist, Maria Magdalena Campos Pons, C-A-M-P-O-S-P-O-N-S, Campos Pons, led a procession through the Guggenheim Museum in New York while wearing a tiered dress shaped like the Guggenheim Museum. It was both celebration and protest. Campos Pons had been invited by her friend, the photographer Carrie Mae Weems, to stage a performance for Weems' retrospective exhibition, the first for a black artist in the museum's 55-year history. A video of that performance, Habla la Madre, plays on a continuous loop in the final room of Behold, which is on view at the Nasher. A themed, career-spanning survey of her work, the exhibition is between stops at the Brooklyn Museum, Frist Art in Nashville, where she works as a professor at Vanderbilt, and the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles. In the video, Campos Pons invokes Santeria Orisha's deities, smashes plates on the floor, and releases goldfish into the Guggenheim's fountain, all while encircled by rings of white fabric that echo the form of the famed Frank Lloyd Wright design building. For the first time in the institution's history, she told the Indy she had made the black body into the, quote, spinning center of the Guggenheim. The performance was a powerful expression of rage at the historical exclusion of black people from venerable art institutions, but also an homage to beautiful building and an artist whom Campos Pons loves. She sees Frank Lloyd Wright and herself as part of the same lineage, descended from Yamaya, the Orisha of water. He too is the son of Yamaya, even though he doesn't know it, she says. Although Behold, curated by Carmen Hermo and Maisie Harris with Jeannette Daria Strand, consists mostly of photographs and works on paper, Habla la Madre embodies the idiosyncratic version that defines Campos Pons' multimedia oeuvre. She says, I started doing performance art when I couldn't express what I was feeling and thinking through painting, drawing, sculpturing, printmaking, film or video, any of those. And I wanted to become a body, a thing that feels, milks, spits, and cries. The body is a locus of connection for Campos Pons. Here, hers is a world in which every being, Frank Lloyd Wright, Santeria, Orishas, and everything in between, is linked by tendrils of history, family, land, and spirit. In Umbilical Cord, 1991, one of the earliest pieces on display in Behold, photographs of Campos Pons and five of her female relatives are threaded by a wire wrapped with fabric and Cuban soil. Above the photograph is a portrait of Campos Pons' grandmother, their common ancestor. She was born in 1959 and grew up in Matanzas, Cuba, on the same sugar plantation where her great-grandfather Gabriel had been enslaved. She has Cantonese ancestors who were brought to Cuba as indentured laborers in the 19th century. A child of diaspora who has since lived and worked on multiple continents, she is interested in how to locate identity in dislocation, how to explain, for example, the fact that a religious tradition like Santeria could emerge from the violence and dispossession of the transatlantic slave trade. She's best known for her photographic assemblages, which are usually self-portraits and are always shot using a large-format Polaroid camera. In Finding Balance, a work from 2015, she looks magisterial in an antique Chinese theatrical costume. Her face is white with cascarilla, that's an eggshell powder used in Santeria. Arrestingly beautiful and technically accomplished, the 8x13-foot composition, that's 28 separate photographs, occupies an entire wall in the exhibition and has an otherworldly presence. Many of the compositions on display at the Nasher are triptychs, including the haunting Identity Could Be a Tragedy, 1996, a trio of self-portraits. Campos Pons engages with identity not as a set of hyphenate categories, but as a collection, of vital linkages, umbilical cords, perhaps, that reach across time and space. Through color, composition, and performance, she presents intersectionality as it was originally formulated by the black feminists of the Combahee River Collective, shared identity as a source of communal power. And she says, identity confuses us in what we are and makes us think of ourselves in a kind of conflicting space with others. That is tragic. One of the things that marks identity is a capacity to relate. In her assemblages, frames become spaces of visual connection and disconnection. They link as they divide, like the sea between continents. Several of the compositions on view evoke the ocean with vivid blues and rich symbolism, most notably in De los Dos Aguas, of the two waters, with its twists of hair connecting each element in the scene. But the ocean otherwise appears in several somewhat disappointing watercolor and gouache works, which don't have the force or formal inventiveness of the photographs. One of the most moving works on display, however, is not a photograph. It's titled Spoken Softly with Mama. It's a sculptural seance, images and videos of Campos Pons' ancestors are projected onto seven ironing boards that stand upright in a dark room. ghostly cast glass irons are arranged in a kind of mandala between them. Nearby, TRA 1991 summons the horrors of the Middle Passage with carved wooden sculptures that depict bodies packed into slave ships. In stark emotional contrast, the installation also includes photographs of smiling Afro-Cubans, descendants of those who survived that crossing. Campos Pons makes history material, reminding us in a vivid Santeria color palette that we all exist somewhere in a vast web of connection. She says, between past and present, an exhibition like Behold should be a place for mediation. I carry a lot of pain and anguish and lacerations from history, the past that I get to know and acknowledge, but also incredible amounts of joy and hope and trust that it's so difficult, but the best days are ahead and should be built together. Now, as I conclude this, ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, I am aware, certainly, of what NC Reading Service does. Our clientele is, as I say, blind and print impaired. So if you take a moment or two, interested enough to communicate with the NC Reading Service, to let me know specifically whether visual, intensely visual art comments are apropos. I can leave those articles beside. It does say visually impaired, which implies we can get to some visual type things. And so, as we know, vision is so much part of the general culture that I'll need to be brought, instructed, basically, by you folks. So if you can get to ncreadingservice.org, leave an email. There's a phone number that you could leave a verbal message saying either a few of these articles now and then are fine, or cut them out. It's not doesn't not do us any good. I'd be appreciating hearing that. Thank you. And then on to another museum, and that is, in effect, the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. And this is sort of exciting. Treasures will be discovered and fortunes found during the 28th season of Antiques Roadshow, which premieres on PBS on January 8th. But North Carolinians will be in for a special viewing experience this year, as three episodes filmed in Raleigh back then air for the first time in April next month. Antiques Roadshow and its hundreds of expert appraisers, volunteers, and camera crew came to the North Carolina Museum of Art earlier this year, marking their second visit to Raleigh and the fourth to North Carolina. The one-day-only event drew thousands of people from across the state, each lugging thrift store finds and decades-old heirlooms behind them in the hopes of striking gold. One guest did just that, according to Antiques Roadshow press release. The unnamed participant, quote, was astounded to find that a $15 thrift store painting was revealed to be a $100,000 treasure by the Vietnamese artist Le Pho, made around 1950. Other surprises are sure to be in store this season, with Antiques Roadshow having also visited Anchorage, Alaska, Sturbridge, Massachusetts, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Akron, Ohio, in addition to Raleigh. Executive producer Marsha Bemko said in this release, "We have a big season ahead for fans, which includes locations rich in history, alongside items and guests that reveal hidden stories, first-person experiences, and some whopping values. And I was touched to see items from PBS icons Fred Rogers and Bob Ross make their way to the show." The Roadshow's Raleigh episodes will premiere on PBS April 1st, 8th, and 15th. And these are each one-hour shows, I believe. The 1st, 8th, and 15th. So, mark those calendars. Over in Durham now. Durham's Perfect Lovers walk in there, and you might be privy to an impromptu dance performance featuring local professionals. You might stumble across a tattooing pop-up with a dozen clients mid-tattoo. You'll definitely be able to sip espresso from local coffee brewers Black and White and Joe Van Gogh or Georgia-based Caption Coffee while taking in art hanging on handmade mobile gallery walls. When thinking over the vision for Perfect Lovers, which opened in February of 2022, owner Carrie Elzey wanted it to feel more like a coffee pop-up within a gallery than a coffee shop that also happened to have some art on the walls. And it worked. Most of the space, located off North Roxborough Street beside Red Start Foods, is dedicated to a rotating show or performance instead of the usual tables and semi-comfortable chairs you'll find at most coffee shops, even during espresso hours, which run 9 to 2, Tuesday through Saturday. The shop is the culmination of two of Elzey's great loves. They trained at Aurora Coffee, Atlanta's first specialty coffee shop, and their instincts have been honed over more than a decade spent in the industry. After then completing their MFA in new genres, when I ask what that means, they answer, "Whatever you want it to mean, that's fine. It's not medium bound." At the San Francisco Art Institute in 2010, they knew they wanted to get back into the specialty coffee industry. This isn't Elzey's first coffee shop. They opened a space called Two Clocks in Decatur, Georgia in 2018 with a roasting partner. When the lease was up in 2020, Elzey decided to move to Durham. The names of both shops pay homage to the same sculpture by the Cuban-born American artist Felix Gonzalez Torres. Untitled, parentheses, Perfect Lovers, which is made up of two analog wall clocks ticking, initially at least, in time. Gonzalez Torres created many sculptures out of ordinary objects whose gravity comes partly from their context. While Elzey didn't start drinking coffee until they were in their 30s, and even now say they only need one cup a day, they appreciate the work it takes to grow and pull a good espresso shot and have high standards for their coffee. They know the ideal measurements for a shot of ground coffee and a pulled shot, but they're seasoned enough to rely mostly on their instincts. Despite all this, though, Elzey isn't a coffee shop. Their goal for the shop is mostly about making people happy. Roxborough, a notoriously busy road, as you may have heard from that earlier article, doesn't get much foot traffic. At times, Elzey has struggled to keep the shop open, saying, "There have been many times when I thought maybe I should just close. I think anybody that potentially had a family, other kinds of obligations, or other standards for income probably would have given up." But the community has come through, too. Elzey continues, "There are a lot of generous people offering up time and connections. People donate to my GoFundMe. They've donated plants and a cool robot vacuum cleaner. People were just willing to help. At times, I haven't even asked." The first 2 years of running the shop have come with ups and downs, but Elzey's goal for the next few years is simple. More of the same with less struggle. And business does seem to be picking up. They're seeing more people come in for coffee and hosting more private parties in the space. "I'm hopeful," they say. "I think it's turning a corner." Over the past 2 years, there have been yoga classes, melancholy Pilates, spoken word performances, and the occasional acoustic set at Perfect Lovers. The art scene that cycles in and out of the space is driven highly by community and word of mouth. Poet and musician Dylan Angel remembers meeting Elzey at a show and how quickly they offered their space up for events. Angel, who has organized a few shows at Perfect Lovers, loves the DIY nature of that space. At a January rendition of Evenings, a quarterly interdisciplinary arts event he organizes with fellow artists Victoria Boulobasis and Loan Tran, he estimates nearly 100 people ended up gathering in that space. The trio has utilized other places around Durham before, but Angel says those spaces haven't offered the same level of connection, saying, whatever we're trying to create, it's important to be able to make eye contact with every single person in the room and have the level of intimacy that you have at Perfect Lovers. At a recent show, someone who doesn't live in Durham told Angel they feel the city is the center of the North Carolina art scene, quote, because you can never really define what it is, so it feels like it's kind of always recreating itself. And he says, I think the Perfect Lovers is recreating itself every day, so I feel like the art that lands there is stuff that's ambitious and interesting. It's experimental enough that it doesn't quite have a place yet. The dancer, Lons Reuter, is one of a pair of local dancers who regularly perform and practice in that space during the day. She's also had her work displayed on a video loop in Perfect Lovers and hosted performances in the evening and occasionally teaches a class called Melancholy Pilates, too, which she describes as, quote, a horizontal laying down movements that we all do together to sad songs for about an hour. Reuter's dance partner, Anna Maynard, initially approached Elsie about dancing in the space during coffee shop hours, and Reuter said it's been really special to animate the space with dancing, especially when there isn't even an event or exhibit up. It's just a giant black slate for like 60% of the room, so we've had people on the Zoom calls in the front while we're like noodling in the background with some bird soundscape playing. It's been really nice to find ways for it to coexist and not be disruptive, not demand attention, but just short of share the tension in the room. If you don't want to look at your computer, we're just bodies moving. And Reuter loves the way Elsie is just up for anything. When Reuter proposed Melancholy Pilates, Elsie jumped immediately to scheduling. It wasn't if, says Reuter, it was how. And that made it feel so like a partnership. As Durham continues to build the same luxury 5-over-1 apartment buildings, Reuter would love to see more spaces like Perfect Lovers. Durham has previously seen scrappy do-it-yourself learning arts communities in spaces like the Mothership, Man Bites Dog, and the Carrack, all of which have closed in the last 5 years. Reuter says, noting the cost to maintain the space, there's a long history in Durham of spaces like this, and we're definitely in a moment of having fewer of them. It will be cool with all those condo buildings if some had some community space. I have visions for how this space could coexist and be supported by our city, but in the meantime, Perfect Lovers fills a gap and upholding the long legacy of spaces like this. If you are interested in attending an upcoming event, the best way to stay on top of the schedule is through the Perfect Lovers Instagram account. Ali Blois, B-L-O-I-S, Ali Blois, will be playing on March 22nd, I think that's tomorrow, and a campaign to write letters asking Governor Cooper to commute the sentences of prisoners condemned to death will take place on March 25th. Mark Adams, Secretary of Local Arts Collective Synchronicity Arts, has been to more than half a dozen events and performances at Perfect Lovers, saying, I like that it's a flexible space where you can meet different types of people. There's a malleability to it. I've never seen it set up the same way twice. I describe Elsie and their space as unpretentious but uncompromising. It's a hard line to walk. The espresso is very, very good, But ordering in Perfect Lovers doesn't feel like your classic intimidating craft coffee shop with a too-cool-to-chat barista. In fact, Elsie's pretty much the only one who pulls shots during the week unless a friend comes in to cover an urgent need. The art leans contemporary but feels grounded and well-contextualized. The shop has given Elsie, who's originally from Maryland, an intense appreciation for Durham. There's just something about Durham, they say. I think people just are looking out for each other. They're turning to the community again for partnerships to keep things running smoothly. There's a nearly funded GoFundMe, and Elsie has recently started partnering with Piedmont Wholesale Flowers, which sells flowers out of the space 3 days a week. Wholesale from 9 to 12 on Tuesday and Thursday, and to the public 8 to 10 on Friday, to alleviate some of the rent pressure. For now, they're just excited to see who else will walk through their door. Well, thanks to my own memory issues, I don't recall if I read this last week, but it's worth going into again. Full Frame Festival announces its 2024 programming. This April marks the first in-person full-frame documentary festival in 5 years, also the first without Nancy Bwirsky, the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning filmmaker who founded that festival. Bwirsky, who directed the festival for a decade, died last August at the age of 78. On Thursday, the Downtown Durham Festival released its full slate of programming for the sprawling April 4 through 7 event. That's coming right up, folks. April 4 through 7th. It includes 50 titles, 35 features, and 15 short films from 22 countries. And it's titled In Process, Documenting Creativity. The festival's annual thematic program and is curated by filmmakers Jessica Edwards and Gary Hustwit, who were originally tapped to curate the 2020 program, which was canceled due to, guess what, COVID. Subsequent festivals in 21 and 22 were held virtually, while the 23 festival was paused amid institutional uncertainty at Duke's Center for Documentary Studies. The center has organized the event since its inception. The festival will hold a tribute for Bwirsky alongside filmmaker D.A. Pennybacker, a full-frame board member who died in 2019. Co-festival director and artistic director Sadie Tillery wrote in a press release, "Remembering Nancy and Penny, I cannot think of two people who are more responsible for shaping Full Frame as a cultural institution. Full Frame would not be Full Frame without them, and it means the world to me to highlight their invaluable contributions this year." The tribute showcases three of Bwirsky's films, including The Loving Story, a documentary about an interracial couple behind the history-making Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia. The tribute will also feature four documentaries by Pennybacker, who often trained his camera on mid-century icons like Bob Dylan, Duke Ellington, and Norman Mailer. Music icons emerge as a theme elsewhere in the festival with the screening of Eno, directed by Hustwit and produced by Hustwit and Edwards, following the creative process of musician Brian Eno. Tillery says, "Full Frame is enormously proud of this year's new docs and invited programs. These selections come from around the world and illustrate a stirring array of ideas and lived experiences. They also exemplify the craft of documentary filmmaking, its extraordinary range of form and approach." Super Empty's Song of the Week is Stand Tall by Rhapsody. Given her cerebral nature, writes Ryan Coca, it's fitting that the music video for Rhapsody's personal soul-searching new single, Stand Tall, can't actually get into the music before engaging in its own bit of meta-commentary. Tucked into a blank studio in the back of a bare industrial space, the MC is engaged in an interview with actress Sana Lathan, intimately discussing inspirations, risk-taking, the pair's relationship. After a while, though, the usual distance interview shots give way to straight-on, uncomfortably tight close-ups. The conversation shifts to the matter of authenticity, and we get into the real question Lathan has been wanting to ask. Are you into guys? Are you into girls? Are you into... It's a brutal skewering of the landscape we now all inhabit, one in which surging popularity of long-form podcasts has nonetheless coincided with the ever-increasing need for thoughtless, bite-sized entertainment, one in which it's important to concern ourselves with sophisticated, high-minded subjects like intimacy and authenticity, but it's also important to get the likes. For homegrown, intellectual, and concept-forward artist rolling out her first album since before TikTok, BT, Rhapsody, taking a keen interest in that dubious state of thing would make sense in and of itself. But the Jamla MC's preoccupation likely comes from a more personal space, given that the notion of authenticity is something she's arguably been circling and wrestling with, her entire career. There's the relatively simple linear way to describe Rhapsody's career to this point: years of indie hustling as a heady no BS lyricist, then a major industry cosign, a mainstream breakout moment, and an ensuing fan support and critical acclaim, a Grammy nomination for Best Rap Album in 2017. Then there's a more complicated one, a persistent gap, or at least an appearance of one, between the breadth of her industry Rolodex and the size of her fan base. Skepticism, undoubtedly sexism-fueled, about whether she's been lifted up by the apparatus around her, or if she's been deservedly swept off her feet by organic support, and apparently a nagging and overly nosy concern about who she likes to, you know. Well, here comes our music again, and I have to curtail this article from Indie Week, which was printed on March the 15th, and it's called The Song of the Week, Rhapsody. You can go to indieweek.com and read all these and many, many more stories, the Reader's Guide to Best of the Triangle, and all sorts of good things. It's free to go on to online for IndieWeek, indieweek.com. But for now, John Feddersen, John, is signing off this week's empty episode. I'll be back in 2 weeks from today and read another Indie Week for you. So long from the ncreadingservice.com.